This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Helen Farmer with you on today's episode. We were asking, are you addicted to skincare? Talking about the psychology of aesthetics treatments with both a psychologist and consultant dermatologist, Dr. Natalia Spearings. We were also in conversation with Emirati ice skater Zara Larry, talking about her rise to the top, being the first to compete in a hijab, and why writing a children's book had to be the next step. And learning everything you need to know about savings with national bonds. The products are available to locals and expats, both long and short term. And in a psychology hour, a deep dive into depression has revealed the top countries most medicated for the condition. I love a busy studio, and I can guarantee we're going to have a busy text line as well today. Not one, but two experts in the studio as we talk about the psychology of aesthetic treatments. Now, the Reddit group Skincare Addiction now has 2 million subscribers. That's up from 500,000 just a few years ago. We are spending more than ever before. But are we seeing any rise in our happiness levels? Figures from Google Trends show a massive increase in the searches for Botox, injectables, skincare over the last few years, and more than doubled in the UK, coronavirus being a big, big uptick there. The hashtag skincare routine has garnered a staggering 55 billion views on TikTok. To bring us back down to earth, talk about the psychology of skincare and aesthetics. So if you are struggling with an addiction to Sephora, or indeed you've got a partner who maybe can't stay away from the clinic, please get in touch, because joining us from Reverse Psychology, Amaryllis Harris is with us today. Psychologist who's got decades of experience. She specialises in treating children, adolescents, adults and families through an integrative approach. And we've got Dr. Natalia Spearings here as well. Consultant dermatologist. She practices between the UK and here in Dubai, where she's based at King's College Hospital. She is famed for her no-nonsense and money-saving approaches. Her book, Skintelligent, What You Really Need to Know to How to Get Great Skin, is out now. Lovely to have you both with us. Dr. Natalia, back in Dubai.
Yes,
how long for?
6 weeks, so all through the holidays.
Okay, and are you fully booked?
I'm actually fully booked.
Okay, right. So, yeah. But that's my quick way of saying, guys, if you want some skincare advice, questions, if you've acne, eczema, aesthetics, you can message me. That's probably the quickest way to get through to Dr. Natalia Spearings right now on 4001. Can we start with the psychological side? Would that be okay?
We can.
Because, as I said, you've been practicing for about 20 years now. Do you feel like this conversation's changed? This is coming up in clinic, and previously, not so much?
I think it's changed in so many ways. Like, our awareness of it has changed. The influences on us have changed, and the body ideals have changed. I mean, we're such social creatures. Like, our norm is what we see around us, but it's now not just what we see on telly and magazines, but in social media. Like, we were just chatting outside and talking about, when Natalia and I were growing up, it was heroin chic, you know, it was like kind of Kate Moss, waif, thin bodies. And like the underlying psychological message there was, if you work hard enough in terms of like controlling yourself, in, you know, not overindulging, if you're restraining enough, then you can be beautiful too. Mm. Whereas it's changed now.
It's hugely changed. And, you know, we've got, body ideals that can be achieved, you know, through healthy means. And we've got body ideals which are literally inhuman.
There's literally unnatural.
Totally unnatural. I'm not going to say which hotel I was in recently in Dubai, but I got a shock when one particular woman stood up from the chair in reception. I was like, that
can't be real.
That's definitely not real. And where did you buy jeans to accommodate such an addition? It was quite staggering. But I wanted to ask you, Amaryllis, a little bit about how our perception is kind of beauty and aesthetic preferences are influenced, you know, these psychological factors. Because, you know, what you touched on there is, you know, our reality is what we surround ourselves by. And when I was growing up, it was, you know, the odd copy of Just 17 magazine and the other girls in my class. Now it is coming at you from all angles. What's the psychological impact of those kind of these perceptions and comparisons?
I mean, we are, you know, we're socially relating to each other all the time. We are doing that comparison piece. But as you say, if you're comparing with what's on social media that could be filters that we all know, you know, our rational brain says this cannot be real, you know. Mm. But
gosh, she looks good.
Yeah, exactly. But gosh, I want to look like that, yeah. You know. It still has that effect on us. And we know that there's more likes, more clicks for things that, you know, it might be that more curvaceous look now. It might be someone that has the smoother skin in the world or the bigger lips that aren't specifically natural to them. But it does, it gets in our minds, it gets underneath.
And this is us speaking, as I would say, pretty media savvy people, let alone, you know, developing, you know, adolescent brain.
Exactly.
Dr. Natalie, can I ask you about, I guess, the ethics a little bit, if you don't mind. You know, how do you assess the psychological suitability of someone who is seeking an aesthetic treatment? And we should be very clear, you're not here as a plastic surgeon doing, you know, BBLs, but, you know, you do some aesthetic procedures. What kind of factors do you consider?
So I look at the history of aesthetic procedures and how happy they were with them previously. So that's a big part of it. So, like, what have you done before and were you happy? And that's one way of looking at it. If they're always unhappy and they're never satisfied, that's a red flag. Mm-hmm. You know, so have you ever liked having Botox before? No, I never. No one's ever done it correctly. I'm like, okay. You know, then that's wrong. So for me, it's about just talking to them and getting their history from them and then understanding what they want. And, like, what are you hoping to achieve through having this today? I don't ask it quite like that, but I get a vibe. I know it sounds weird, but I get a vibe. I spend a lot of time talking to patients, so I get a vibe, and then I can kind of judge. And I do follow the ethical rules, which are, you know, give patients a 2-week cooling off period after they've had the consultation. This is we're talking about, like, lip filler here. So this is not like massive surgery or anything, but even for that, which is considered small, mm-hmm. I would still give them at least a 2-week cooling off period.
What procedures are popular right now? Can we talk men and women?
Yeah, so always the most popular procedure, and at least in my clinic, is always going to be Botox. Because it, or neurotoxin. It works well, it's cost effective. And so that's a standard that everyone kind of knows works well. And aside from that, it's people looking for skin tightening treatments. That's these non-invasive facelifts. This is like the big thing that's really exploding. I don't do those treatments because they don't work. I avoid them.
But spoiler
I do
have,
yeah, spoiler, sorry. But I do have to deal with all the questions and the effects that people have when they do have them.
Interesting. And are you seeing a rise in men coming into clinic looking for aesthetics as well?
Yes. Yeah, especially Botox, but not telling anyone else.
No,
obviously.
Course not.
Yeah, a bit of Botox, you don't tell anyone.
Botox.
Yeah, just a little bit around the eyes, you know, that kind of thing. So yes, absolutely. And pigmentation treatment as well, it's kind of interesting.
And to come back to the point earlier about how trends and influences change, you know, that kind of super frozen look was the thing
yeah.
A few years ago. Do you feel like that's changed, or do you have people come in, you're like, you don't need any more Botox in your face? What are you talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. So, but I think my patient population is quite kind of a unique group anyway, that they always want to look natural. Almost all of my patients always want to look natural. So, like, I want to have no lines, but I'd like to look natural. I'm like, okay, well, that's not natural. I know what you want. So
pick a lane.
Pick a lane. Like, I understand what you want. So let me see what I can do.
Okay, right. We are going to delve further into this. We're going to even get into a bit of around addictions, about realistic expectations as well. Joining us in studio from King's College Hospital, Dr. Natalia Spearings, consultant dermatologist, and we have got psychologist from Reverse, Amaryllis Harris, as we talk about, I was going to say the word addiction, but actually I think that is what I mean, to aesthetic treatments, to skincare, to, you know, I mean, Dr. Natalia, you've said before, you do not need to have a magnifying mirror.
No, definitely not.
Step away from the magnifying mirror. But I wanted to ask you about the psychological side in terms of people developing a reliance on aesthetic treatments, whether that is, you know, Botox, fillers, you know, getting the cosmetic side, to maintain how they look. How can that reliance impact mental health, self-image, self-worth even?
I think it does have a huge link to self-worth, because there's always something more that can be done. Mm-hmm. And if you take your body and your face as something to be fixed, if you look at it as a problem to be solved, then, you know, it seems like you're not really ever going to be happy. You can have I guess you've got to look at the motive. Why am I doing this? And what's going to be the consequences, short and long term? Like, short term, maybe I'm really happy. Like, maybe my lips give me a lot of pleasure. Brilliant, you know, like, go for it. But if it then leads on to discontent over something else, now I'm noticing, oh, you know, maybe my cheeks aren't looking great, or maybe my eyelids are a bit yuck, or, you know, whatever it is. I guess it's looking at the motive, looking at the consequences. What's really going on underneath? Is there actually some emotional stuff that's happening under there that we're trying to fix through fixing our bodies rather than fixing the deeper stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, not comparable in terms of, you know, skin and face stuff, but I know when I was, you know, looking to lose weight, I was like, okay, when I get to this number in my jeans, or when it says this on this number of kilos,
I'll be happy.
And, you know, I would say I'm happier now that I am fitter, like the benefits of, you know, being healthier, but it's really isn't about the number, but that was a very long process. And I mean, do you see that, Natalia, about people kind of coming in and saying, I just want one more this, or is just a few more ml this time?
yeah, absolutely. And it's my responsibility to talk them down.
Okay.
So, you know, it's the clinician, the physician's responsibility to do the right thing for the patients holistically, not just for their lip volume, but for everything. And to that is what we're trained to do. So when doctors don't do that, that always worries me. So, you know, it is my responsibility to say, no, your lips look great the way they are. If you had any more, you'd look weird, and it's better to look old than look weird. So let's just stick with that. You know, so it is my job. And though it is a lot, it has to do with my own, you know, perception of what is beautiful. That's correct. It's very subjective. Mm-hmm. But I will not, I kind of had this thing where I won't do something to someone that I wouldn't do to my own family member.
Fair enough. No name saying here on the text line. Do people just get used to seeing themselves in a certain way, and then it just gets more and more dramatic?
Yeah, especially with selfies and stuff, because you can really change the way you look by, you know, obviously using filters, but also just changing your head position. And then you'll get used to that certain way. And if you don't look like that when you look in the mirror, then you're like, okay, how am I going to fix that? Mm-hmm. And that's, yeah, it's weird.
That's where I feel like you need some good friends around you to go, do you know what, babe, enough's enough.
Enough. That doesn't seem to happen a lot, which is weird.
The sense check.
Yeah, it's like, come on. And I obviously do that for my friends. I'm like, no, let's tone it down. But I mean, I don't think a lot of people would think that.
Interesting.
That.
We are going to have a longer segment after the headlines where we can get into the text lines. We've had a message about, do you build up a tolerance to Botox? When should you start it? Jill's asking about persisting with tretinoin. She's an absolute skincare addict, in her words, but it's just not working. Gone from skin peeling off to mild redness. Arlie asking about a skin regime for her 20-year-old daughter. We're talking about the psychology of aesthetic treatments today. Two experts in the studio. We have seen sharp increases in searches for Botox, injectables, skincare over the last few years. Hashtag skincare routine has been garnering a staggering 55 billion views on TikTok. Amaryllis Harris is with us today from Reverse Psychology, decades of experience with children, adolescents, adults and families. And Dr. Natalia Spearings, consultant dermatologist. She practices between the UK and here, where she can be found at King's College Hospital. We are taking your questions, your concerns, and you can do that in a number of ways. You've got all the numbers. You're more than welcome to give us a call as well. So let's have a little chat now with Verena, who's on the line. How can we help you today?
Yes, hi. I had a question. I had two babies in the last 3 years. And already before that, I've had like incredible amounts of spider veins at a very young age, which is probably also because I have very fair skin. And since I'm like 18, I keep getting them removed with like injections and lasers, but it's never really satisfying, I want to say. It's always a lot behind. And I was just wondering if there's another way or a better way of trying to get rid of these nasty things.
Good question. Dr. Natalia is known for no nonsense, so you might not like what she's going to say, but at least you'll know the truth.
I have a fear of that, yeah.
Come on, Natalia. Yeah.
Is it your legs, right? They're on your legs?
Yeah, it's all over my legs. I mean, obviously the areas where I had them removed, they haven't come back.
They have not come back.
They find other areas.
Do you have any varicose veins?
No, that actually my veins themselves are good. I had vein surgery because the doctor that I've been seeing, he said that I had like an issue with like the backflow of blood in my veins or something, which he fixed. And it seemed to have done the job in a sense where they haven't gone crazy. But obviously, with the two pregnancies, I haven't done anything about it now because I know there is no point. But sort of now I'm at the point where I would like to get rid of them.
Yeah,
again.
So if the microsclerotherapy worked for you before, then that's probably your best bet. But usually if they keep recurring, it's because you still have an underlying valve problem. I'm not a vascular surgeon, but that's what you would want to look at again. So if you haven't had a scan since your pregnancies, it having that scan to look at the Doppler ultrasound to look at your vasculature to see if there's more of an issue there, it's most likely an underlying valve problem still that's driving your spider veins. But then if the microsclerotherapy worked well for you, then that's definitely better than laser. So laser does not work well for them.
Yeah, I had, what he did is for like the big ones, obviously he used injections, which worked well, and I can literally see them disappear.
Yes, yeah, the injections.
But then for the small ones, the laser, that was extremely painful, first of all. And then, I mean, the really small ones, they are very stubborn. You can't get rid of them.
So I would probably say go back and get a scan done, just see what's going on, and then you may need something else done to the actual vessels.
Thanks, Verena. Great question. All the very best. Text lines and phone lines are open. I wanted to ask a message that came in from No Name saying, do you build up a tolerance to Botox? Mine doesn't last as long as it used to. It's an anonymous message on the text line.
So there is case reports of people having antibodies to Botox, and that's what they mean by building up tolerance. So that can happen. It's very rare, and there's no test for that. So we can't check your antibody levels. You can there's a lab in Germany, but it's extremely expensive and it's not necessary. So I wouldn't bother. But usually people just need less Botox as they use Botox for longer. So to have it not last as long can be many different factors. So it can be how the Botox, what brand you have had. Did you change injectors? Is it a different amount that you've had done? Like, there's lots of things like that to think about. And so I would want to kind of take your full history to understand where it, you know, what's happened to understand how to fix the problem.
Okay. Amaris, I wanted to ask you, and I ask this as a parent, about, I guess, protecting, future-proofing our kids to the endless influence of influencers and filters and photo editing apps. And I guess building their resilience and their self-worth so they're not holding themselves up to absolutely, I mean, not just unrealistic expectations, but completely unattainable body types and physicalities. What would you advise any parents who are listening going, gosh, that we feel like we're fighting an uphill battle here?
I think it does feel like that. It feels like the tide is definitely bigger than the force we have to push against it. I think helping them be aware, because we ain't going to stop them. We're not going to stop them using these apps. And it's unrealistic, really, to think that we are. You know, if you do that, if you do the zero, we're not doing that, no apps in my household sort of thing, you're just going to get resentment from the child and they're going to find another way. Mm-hmm. They know all the ways. So, you know, I would say coach, work with, explore with them, you know, how do you feel after using this? Because some, you know, they're quite intuitive, actually, the teens.
And probably watching a bit of our own messaging and what we're saying about our own looks.
So, like, so often when I work with children who are starting on that sort of disordered eating path or have really big problems with their body image, it has started at home. And for well-meaning parents, you know, sometimes parents just really overemphasize healthy diet, make food say good or bad, or, you know, a treat can only come with exercise. And then, of course, you're almost getting in that loop of, God, I've got to compensate now. You know, I've done too much, and it brings the guilt and stuff. But also our own body image, how we talk to ourselves. Like, so often, you know, parents will just talk about, you know, oh, no, I need to lose weight, mm-hmm. or be doing their own dieting. And kids just absorb all this.
She's left the country this morning, so I can say this safely. My cousin was staying with us last week, and she's a very, very, very active person. She knows she works in the fitness industry, and I would say, and she's admitted herself, quite compulsive about food and exercise. And I think I'd offered her something a few days ago for food, and she was like, no. I pigged out last night. I'm on a diet today. And I had to say to her, please just watch the choice of words around the girls, because it really, really freaks me out. And she took it on board. She's like, no, I totally respect that, you know, as a parenting choice. But I was like, I can't have you restricting in front of my kids.
It sticks. I still worry that my thighs are large. I'm quite petite. Like, I know, like, my rational brain, yeah, you're quite petite, you're a petite person. But my mum, a petite person, always thought her thighs were large. And I still have that memory from her talking about
it.
And
it?
She doesn't mean it, didn't, you know, but it just stuck somehow.
Well, so what we're talking about today, addiction, psychology of aesthetic treatments and skincare. And we have a number of messages. We're going to do a bit of a quick fire round on the text line in just a few minutes.
This content is for informational purposes only and does not intend
attempt to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis or treatment.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer on Dubai Eye 103.8.
With Vietnamese foodies, fresh, naturally healthy and affordable dishes with authentic Vietnamese flavours. Order now on all delivery platforms. Visit VietnameseFoodies.com.
We've been talking about the psychology of aesthetic treatments today. Yes, a skincare addiction. Sephora addiction, with Dr. Natalia Spearings, consultant dermatologist. She's based at King's College Hospital when she's here in the UAE, and Amaryllis Harris from Reverse Psychology sharing her insights too. We've got time for one last question, which has come in from Alia saying, my daughter's 20, wants to get into a proper skincare routine. Neither of us know much about skincare despite her TikTok habit. Please, can you recommend any brands that we can go to, learn about, that would give some good advice? She's got quite dry skin.
Okay, so I wouldn't suggest getting advice from a brand. So if you have dry skin, then really basic skincare. So try to avoid foaming cleansers, go for more like milky balm oil cleansers. So no brand in particular, anything you like. They're all pretty much the same. And then with moisturization, if you're drier, then at night, go for a greasy ointment. My prototypical one is the old school Vaseline, but you can also use any other ointment. So keep it simple, keep it basic. Don't use too many products because that's more drying. Don't exfoliate, don't scrub, don't use acids because that's also very drying. Mm-hmm. So keep it very simple, very basic.
Dr. Natalia, your Instagram is an absolute gold mine.
Well, thanks.
I do, I love it. Oh. Of information, resources, and obviously your book, Skintelligent, is out as well. What's the best way of getting in touch with you and maybe getting on the cancellation list?
If you DM me, then I can, you know, tell
find
you how to do that. And there is also the top, the first post also gives you all the details of how to contact the specific person who manages my bookings to put
Amazing.
You on the list.
So it is Dr. Natalia Spearings. If you want to send me the word doc, I'll happily send it. And also for you, Amaryllis, for anyone who wants to get in touch and explore, I mean, we were talking earlier about, you know, you're working with children, teens, couples, you know, families. Where can we find you online and in real life?
Real life, it's Reverse Psychology is just in El Wasl, near the Big Spinneys. And you can get in touch really just by contacting the clinic.
Amazing. Easy. Couldn't be easier, guys. Thank you so, so much. Really important topic. And I think when a lot more people than we realise might be struggling with. If you want details of our two experts, just send me the word docs and I will send you those contact details. 4001. Don't put your name on. No questions asked.
This content is for informational purposes only and does not intend to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis or treatment.
Zara Larry is the first figure skater to compete at an international level in a hijab. She was featured on the Forbes 30 Under 30 last year, a five-time Emirati national champion. Her book, Not Yet, The Story of an Unstoppable Skater, is out now. Zara, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for taking the time away from training and writing and all the rest of it to tell us a little bit about you and a little bit about the book as well. I wanted to start at the beginning. Your journey to compete as the first Emirati figure skater has been really wonderful to see unfold. And I wondered if you wouldn't mind taking us back to the beginning. When did you first become aware of figure skating and what first motivated you to put on some skates?
So I started skating after going to the movie theater with my mom and my younger brother. And it was actually funny because we were supposed to watch some action movie because my brother, obviously, he's not going to watch any kind of Disney girly movies. Mm-hmm. But that movie was sold out. And the only thing that was playing was Ice Princess, which is a figure skating movie that was written by Hadley Davis. And so we went to watch that movie and it was love at first sight. I just fell in love with the sport. I knew I wanted to do it, and I just turned over to my mom, and I just told her I'm going to be a figure skater. Wow. And of course, she just laughed it off because she didn't think I was actually serious, and I was really going to take it seriously. But I kept pushing for it, and my dad picked me up from school the next day and took me to the rink and booked me for my lessons. So
Wow. That's
how it started.
How old were you then?
So I was, when I first stepped on the ice, I was 12 years old.
So that's interesting because we often hear about, you know, if you want to be competing at an international level, basically, if you start at four, it's too late.
Exactly.
So tell us about how quickly you kind of lent into training and how seriously you started taking it then.
Well, actually, for the first, I would say, 2 years, I was not taking it so seriously. I was just going once a week. on Ladies Day, and I was just training and practicing, and I never thought I would do it as competing and international levels. It never crossed my mind. I was just going out there and having fun and doing what I love doing. But my coach saw that I was improving really fast, even though I was going once a week. So she tried to push my mom to bring me more, and went from once a week to eventually being 6 days a week.
Wow.
I was training a lot. And then 1 year we had a summer camp held here in Abu Dhabi, and there is a Romanian coach that was a guest coach, and she came and she saw me skate, and she told me that I'm ready to compete internationally. And that's when I realized that I could start competing, and I started taking it more seriously, and I was training a lot. I was training before school, after school. Skating literally became my life.
As I said, you were the first figure skater to compete at international level wearing a hijab, and your dedication to, you know, breaking stereotypes, promoting inclusivity is really, really commendable. What are your hopes? And we're going to talk about the book later, because I think that's a really important piece. But aside from that, you know, how do you hope that your success in the sport will impact the next generation of athletes, you know, particularly young girls here in the UAE?
I mean, at the moment I'm not competing, but I still want to show girls that they can accomplish anything they want to accomplish. And that's my main goal. I go to schools, I'm talking to children, I'm going to universities, I'm trying my best to target especially the next generation. Mm-hmm. I want to show them that nothing is impossible. Whatever you set your mind to, you can accomplish it, even if you are the first. I was the first at so many different things, but I did it. And yes, it might be a not very easy journey, but the most important thing is you have the right team surrounding you and you can accomplish it. To be honest, we already have a lot of Emirati kids that are skating. A lot of them are really young, but they're starting to take it really seriously. We do have a national team. I always say that all the sweat and tears I went through was definitely worth it, because mm-hmm. seeing these kids come and train and start at a very young age and seeing the sport really grow here in the UAE, it makes it all worth it.
What challenges have you faced along the way, Zara? Have there been any moments you just thought, oh, gosh, this is just too hard?
Oh, yeah, I faced many, many challenges. I think the challenges never end. And that's what I try to always tell people. It's like no matter what you're doing in life, whether it's just in your business, your work, art, sport, whatever it is, there is going to be challenges. It's impossible that you face no challenges. Mm-hmm. But what I was doing, I was always trying to focus on the solution and not the problem. And so it started off with the hijab, but then we don't have enough ice time, we don't have enough rinks. It's a lot of things that came up, and there were days where I really didn't want to do it anymore. But then I see messages through my social media, people talking to me, people sending me these messages. It really motivated me to keep going.
Well, thank you so much. Well, I want to find out about the book next. Joining us on the line, Zara Lakhri. She is the first figure skater to compete, as I said, in hijab international level, 5-time Emirati national champion. And her book, aimed at children, not yet, the story of an unstoppable skater, is out now. Written with Hadley Davis, who you just mentioned there, an author, an essayist and the screenwriter, including that skating classic, Ice Princess. Up next, what is the goal with this book? What was it like writing it, balancing it? And yeah, that the weight of being a role model, how does that sit on her shoulders? That's next. Zahra Lari is the first figure skater to compete at international level wearing hijab. She was on Forbes 30 Under 30, a 5-time Emirati national champion. And she's now an author. Her book, Not Yet, The Story of an Unstoppable Skater, is out now. Tell us about the decision to write a children's book. Really exciting venture. What was the inspiration behind it?
Well, it's not my field. So for me, it was something completely different than what I was used to. But I just knew I wanted to inspire more kids. And I think the best way is writing a children's book. And I think children's book, even me as an adult, I like reading it. Even now, my daughter is 1 year old and I just love sitting there. It's something very special between the parents and the child. Mm-hmm. So I sat with Hadley Davis and trying to come up with ideas. And I think the best thing was for us to write this children's book. And it's basically about my beginning and how it started, and just trying to really inspire the next generation.
What a dream to work with the writer behind the movie that started it all for you, Disney's Ice Princess. What was it like collaborating?
Exactly. For me, it's like a dream come true. I actually met her when I went to California right before COVID. I had training there, and I met her. I sat with her, and we were talking for a long time trying to see how we can collaborate in the future, because like really our stories really connected, and she's a big part of my life right now. And for us to be able to do something together that can really inspire kids is a dream come true.
I'm hesitant to ask this because I know you've just got a new baby, but what's next? Are you planning to get your skates back on? What are you planning for the future?
Well, I'm right now coaching a lot of kids. I'm in charge of the national team. I'm the president of the UAE Winter Sport Federation Figure Skating Committee. So I have a lot going on, and I have also my own club, which is Emirates Skating Club. So a lot of things are going on outside of me training, and I'm really focused more on that at the moment. I'm focused on the next generation of kids that will be representing UAE.
Do you think it's ever too late to put your skates on, even as an adult, and have a go?
Oh, never. It's never late. I mean, we have at the club, we have like ladies that are 65. Our oldest is 65 years old. So, I mean, it's never too late. Just come, even if you don't want to take it seriously, just come and have fun. Just enjoy it. It's a very fun sport.
And what about advice to any parents out there who would love their children to, you know, reach that level of international competition like you have? What can parents do, or indeed not do, to support their children's dreams?
Well, I have two things. The first thing is make sure they want to do it. The kids want to do it. It's not the parents, it's the kids. That's my, any kids coming to train with me, the first thing I see is, does the parent want it, or does the child want it? Because it's really important for the child to have the passion in order for them to improve. And the second thing is just support your kids. Mm-hmm. Yes, sometimes you'll have to bring them to the rink before school at 6 a.m. Whether it's late nights, just try to support them. If they do want to compete at international level, it will require a lot of training and a lot of hours. And to be honest, like my mom had to sacrifice a lot of times away from my brothers. It's a huge family sacrifice, but I mean, at the end of the day, it's definitely worth it.
Well, huge congratulations on your success, your continued success, and the book, which is out now. Not yet. The Unstoppable Story of an Unstoppable Skater is available. And if you want to send me the word book, I will send you the link so you can buy it. It looks like an absolutely gorgeous read. The illustrations look really, really fun as well. Zara, an absolute pleasure to catch up with you. Thank you so, so much for taking the time, and can't wait to see what happens next. That next generation, you can't be it until you see it. And for you to get out on the rink before anyone else, just incredible. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you so much.
Really appreciate it.
This is Money Matters with National Bonds. Save, invest, prosper.
Sounds pretty good, right? We are talking about future planning now. We've got Mr. Sakib Mahmood with us, joining us from National Bonds. Now, the UAE government approved a new optional system for end-of-service gratuities for employees in the private sector and free zones to participate as of September last year. We're talking about long-term planning, where to put your money for maximum gains, maximum returns, and basically educating you on things you might not know are available here in the UAE. How are you this afternoon, sir?
Thank you very much. Thank you, Helen. I'm perfectly fine.
We've got lots to talk about today, because there are about four products that I think are particularly relevant to our listeners today. And I want to start with one called Second Salary, which sounds like a dream come true. Tell us about the idea behind this and what it actually looks like in practice.
All right. So what we realize is that, you know, people in Dubai normally, you know, they don't tend to save much. You know, generally the lifestyle here is that, you know, people spend a lot. And, you know, very late they realize that there is a need to have some kind of second salary available to them to cope up with all the expenses. Mm-hmm. So this is what we did, actually. We came up with this product. The name itself tells you that, you know, it's a second salary. And what we did is that, you know, we created a very flexible product, which you can start saving from day one. And minimum saving tenor is 3 years. And maximum, you can go up to 10 years. So in a ballpark, so it comprises of two phases. First phase is the save phase, where you save. And then you get your income back in the next phase. So, for example, if you save for, say, 5 years, and you're saving 1,000 dirhams per month, so you'll save for the first 5 years. And the next 5 years, you can get this almost 1,400 dirhams back every month.
Wow, that's a nice return.
Yeah. And then, you know, it has the option that you can commute it and take it in one go, mm-hmm. or you want to extend it. For example, you say that, no, I want it for the next 10 years. So you can get about 700, 800 dirhams per month for the next 10 years. So that's how it is, very flexible product available.
We've spoken in the show about the importance of paying yourself first.
Yes.
So you get your salary.
Correct.
And then ultimately, in an ideal world, we'll be automating payments out to our investments, to our savings pot. So this would be a way of doing that. As soon as you get paid, think about that second salary.
Correct. We always advocate that pay yourself first. This is something which we don't realize, actually. You know, a lot of people realize it in the COVID time, that, you know, when they didn't have much savings available. Mm. So personally, I also have actually moved into that zone that, you know, I save my, you know, first of all, I take my money out and save it. And I'm, by the way, saving in second salary myself as well. So it's one of the best paying product. And I'm saving it for my wife as well. So, you know, this is a very, and it's long term by nature. So you can go up to 10 years. So if you save for 10 years, that you get almost 1.5 time of your savings back.
And who's it eligible for? And I'm thinking about, you know, expats, you know, Muslims, non-Muslims. Who's it open for?
We are a Sharia compliant company, but anyone can save with us. And this second salary is available starting from only 1,000 dirhams. And you can save it for your children. And anyone can save it. You know, it's a very open saving platform where anyone can come and start saving. So both expats as well as UAE nationals. Actually, it's a surprising fact was that when we did our survey and then we actually launched it, about 67% of our customers are UAE national in second salary.
Interesting. It's interesting you mentioned the children thing as well, because that's something I think about a lot in terms of having savings pots for my children. I don't really know where to put that. So that 10-year plan, because, yeah, that would get them to, if they go to university or if they decide to not, about the right time frame. What about my 1 million? Are you offering?
Yeah.
Can I? Because the answer is yes.
So you would know that we have one of the biggest rewards program in the country. We pay almost 35 million, actually this year about 35.5 million dirhams back to the customer in rewards, in addition to the profit which we pay back. So there, you know, we give almost 8 million dirhams, 2 million every quarter. So we were thinking of, you know, making everybody a millionaire. So we thought, like, why not, you know, save for your 1 million. And in line with our second salary product, we launched this, you know, My 1 Million. We called it My 1 Million. So I want to save it for that 1 million. And there was a lot of debate in the in-house. We thought that, you know, who will save almost 7,000, 8,000 dirhams per month. But surprisingly, I think we are second month and we already have almost 300-400 customers who are already saving for it. And everybody wants to have that figure, you know, I'm a millionaire now. So, you know, so they become millionaires. So within, I think, this first few months, we have seen a lot of traction in this product. And the best part of this product is that not only individuals, actually companies came in and they said that, you know, okay, we will do partial contribution. So they want to save or retain their employees.
So it's so a company benefit.
Yeah. So what they're doing is, so if you want to save 8,000 dirhams per month, so 4,000 is being put by the company and 4,000 employees paying. So that's one way of retaining your clients, customers as well.
Joining us this afternoon, Mr. Mahmood from National Bonds. If you've got any questions, you're more than welcome to reach out. With Masters here going, how are the savings guaranteed? Patrick wants to know. We're going to talk next about the Golden Pension Plan. How does it align with what the government is planning? And what do we need to know?
This is Money Matters with National Bonds. Save, invest, prosper.
Joining us in the studio from National Bonds, we have got Mr. Mahmood, who's talking us through some products, projects, programs that you might not be aware are available to you. Savings plans, future-proofing your finances. Had a number of questions. We were talking earlier about second salary, about My 1 Million. Message here saying, how are the savings guaranteed? That's from Patrick. Good question, Patrick.
Yep. So as I said earlier, that we are a Sharia compliant structure. So we cannot be guaranteed under that. It's a mudaraba structure where we take the money and invest it and we share the profits back. That's the Sharia structure there it is. But otherwise, we are fully 100% owned by ICD, Investment Corporation of Dubai, which is the government sovereign wealth fund. And we have been running for the last 16 years very successfully, and not even through all these ups and downs, we have been very, very steady. So as you know, not many people would know that we are we were formed by the decree by His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum. So the sole purpose is to ensure that, you know, the culture of saving is inculcated in the country. So the whole intent and purpose is not to get into some very risky investments and all, rather inculcate the saving habits. So it's quite guaranteed, I would say. We can't say it otherwise.
A message here saying, can I save for 3 years and then if I wanted to extend it rather than withdrawing the money, is that possible? We're talking there about, you know, 3 years, 10 years, different savings plans. So correct. If you wanted to extend it past your initial commitment, is that possible?
And that's possible. Actually, it's minimum of 3 years. So you can extend it up to 10 years. Actually, we have special programs because we kept it at 10 years to make people understand how it works. Mm-hmm. But from 3 years to 10 years, anywhere you can actually save.
And lastly, the Golden Pension Plan. We don't think about pensions that often as expats here in the UAE, but National Bonds is thinking about it for us. What do we need to know? Can you give us a quick rundown? Who's eligible? And basically, how do you participate?
All right. So Golden Pension Plan is more for employers than employees. So these are, you know, we directly come in contact with the employers. A lot of companies have actually already subscribed to it. We have more than 163 companies which have already applied for it. So here, what they have is their existing end-of-service benefits. They place it with us, and we give a return back to the customer. And our systems are capable of managing this at employee level, at employer level overall, and wherever the employer also wants to contribute with employees together. Mm-hmm. So we can manage that as well. So this is basically their existing end-of-service benefits. They can start saving with us with National Bonds. So that's the structure.
A message saying, with the savings, is it locked or can you withdraw any time? So let's say you commit to 10 years, but it gets to 5 and you think, okay, I'm leaving the UAE, my circumstances to change, I can't save XYZ anymore. How flexible is it there?
So the good thing about all our products is that your principal is not at risk at all in any way. Whatever you have saved, so you've saved 100 dirhams. So maybe your profit is reduced because you have not completed the term. Mm-hmm. It doesn't go to zero in any way. And your principal is always protected. So that's how, you know, we operate. So you can always redeem after the first 30 days.
I had a look on the website and even me, who is not down with the financial jargon, found it really, really easy to understand the different offerings, the time frames, the commitments and the ability to participate. So with your permission, if people want to send me the word save, let's manifest some good savings.
Why not?
If people want to send me the word save to 4001, I'll share the website. People can find out the product, the program for them, and then obviously speak to your team if needs be to take it forward.
Thank you very much for having me
today.
Thank you.
Ramadan Kareem, it's been a pleasure to meet
you.
And
very much.
As I said, to have an understanding of what is available to us as expats, as locals, for really putting those long-term savings in place, whether it's for us or our children. That's going to be my weekend project. Get a couple of savings pots for the kids. Welcome to the Psychology Hour, and we're having a bit of a deep dive into depression today, and I promise it will not be depressing. We are here to help bust myths, take questions and inform you. We're asking, which country is the most medicated for depression and why? America is often labelled as the most depressed or drugged up nation, but that might have been a bit overblown. Figures of global antidepressant usage per capita suggest that Iceland has the largest share of citizens on antidepressants. Figures compiled by Our World in Data analyse the number of prescriptions doled out in 22 countries, broken down as a rate per 1,000 people. So Iceland, which suffers from notoriously long, dark winters, has fewer than 4,000 residents. And then you had Portugal and Canada following closely behind. USA has a rate of 110 per 1,000 people, putting it fifth in place. UK following behind in seventh. And South Korea, meanwhile, took the bottom spot with 27 prescriptions per 1,000 residents, as where depression and therapy have largely been considered taboo. What about you? We'd love to help you out if you are struggling. Maybe there's someone in your life who's been struggling with depression. Maybe you've got some questions about it. Please, please, please do reach out, because Dr. Thry, the clinical psychologist, is on hand today from the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. How are you, Dr. T?
I'm well, Helen. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm a bit croaky. I feel better than I sound. So you might be carrying me towards the end of this hour. But no, all is good. All is good. I find this really, really fascinating, because you and I have referred to depression in many a conversation, but I feel like we haven't really done that deep dive into it in terms of what's happening in our body and our brains. You know, who is at risk? What does treatment look like in 2024? So thank you. And of course, taking questions too. So can I ask you that? Let's start with that. What happens in our brains when we are clinically depressed? I'm not talking about sadness or grief or fleeting emotions. I'm talking about clinical depression. What happens in the brain?
You know, Helen, it's really interesting, because we actually have a hypothesis of a chemical imbalance, and that chemical imbalance has to either do with serotonin, with norepinephrine, and with dopamine. And I think anybody who will unequivocally tell you that we know exactly what happens in the brain with when it comes to depression would be completely lying, because the reality is that we don't exactly know how depression really is affected in the brain. However, what we know the usual suspects. So like I mentioned, serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine, these are the things that are affected quite a bit. And there is, as many things in the field of psychiatry and psychology, there's a lot of research that has also kind of looked at it and said, well, you know, maybe there's a fallacy here about the chemical imbalance hypothesis, and that, you know, maybe it's not chemical imbalance and maybe it's something else. So we still don't have the actual reasons why this occurs, but we do have a significant amount of research that shows contributing factors to developing depression, such as genetic factors if it's in the family. Mm-hmm. For instance, biological factors, like I mentioned, serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine. We also have, like, the way the person lives, their lifestyle makes a very big difference, how they behave, their personality traits. Certain personality traits tend to be more prone to depression than other personality traits, the type of upbringing that they had, the childhood trauma, things like that. So these are contributing factors, but we do not have, the blood test or the X-ray or so on and so forth that will tell us exactly why depression and what is happening in the brain when it comes to depression.
Dr. Thry with us today. As I said, we are tackling this topic head on today. We've had messages asking, is it safe to be on antidepressants for more than 5 years? About how to support a husband. I'm going to be asking Dr. Thry next, when we look at that list of countries, why are some common reasons why the people in those countries might be depressed? And also, how effective are antidepressants in treating depression? How do you know who is a good candidate and when? That's next. Dr. Thry, clinical psychologist, with us live from the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. We're looking into some research that revealed which countries are prescribing the most antidepressants, Iceland taking the number one slot. It does talk, Dr. T, about significant variations in antidepressant prescription across various, these 22 different countries. What factors do you think contribute to these disparities, these numbers? What do we need to understand when we're looking at that data?
Well, I think definitely we have seen that a lot of people experience what we call seasonal affective disorder, which is a contributing factor to depression. So in certain cases where people are not getting enough sunlight, it can really affect their mood quite a bit. Some people tend to experience a lot of isolation and loneliness in areas where the weather is not conducive to them going out and maybe being more physically active. So these are definitely factors that can contribute to an increase in depression. But I would also say it also depends on the way certain people diagnose depression as well as medicate depression. Mm-hmm. So although there is an actual proper standardized way amongst the medical community, but person upon person, psychiatrists could could play different roles in how they prescribe medications and to whom. I mean, we have seen that there has been a significant gender bias when it comes to men and women when it comes to prescribing antidepressants. So usually men are not prescribed as much as women are when it comes to antidepressants, because the psychiatrist will usually attribute depressive symptoms in men as stress related to work, whereas the same symptoms seen in a woman will be more likely to be diagnosed as depression. So it's interesting to see that.
That's super interesting. I mean, also, I guess, you know, different cultures, different attitudes towards seeking help. You know, you're going to see higher numbers if it's more accepted to be, you know, to be more open about mental health. And as you're saying, depending on who's diagnosing and indeed prescribing. I want to come back to what you were talking about earlier, which was like, we, you know, there's still a bit of a degree of mystery about what happens in the body and the brain. But you mentioned some genetic factors there. So do you feel like you can have a predisposition towards depression?
Of course, there is a predisposition. But like I said, Helen, you know, it's really hard to separate two confounding variables, which is the genetic aspect and also the learned behavior. So, for instance, if you have a family member, be it mother or father, who have suffered from major depressive disorder and have had quite a bit of difficulty in your developmental years, you're observing that behavior and you're also learning that behavior and that learned helplessness, let's say, or you're learning the way that they deal with difficulties. So, are we 100% clear about which part is genetic and which part is learned behavior? No, we're not. But what we can, what we have seen is that there is quite a significant amount of people that we can we have diagnosed with major depressive disorder that have other individuals in their families with the same disorder.
Can I ask you a little bit about then why, and I know you're a psychologist, so you don't prescribe medication as such, as it would be a psychiatrist or, you know, your doctor that would do that. But, you know, how does someone ascertain that antidepressants are the best route for someone who's coming in with depressive symptoms?
Well, the first thing that I would say is normally what will happen is anybody who has extreme thoughts of harming themselves, this would be our number one go-to when it comes to prescribing an antidepressant. We also look for functionality. If a person is not able to function in at least two areas of their life over a span of at least 2 weeks, then we are and have the cluster of symptoms that we're looking for, then we do diagnose with depression. Now, some individuals who have an experience of major depressive disorder can have a single episode, which may not necessarily require medication if they make the necessary life changes in their lifestyle. However, if we see that the depression is quite recurrent and the person is really wants to try to help themselves and move forward but isn't able to, there's just something that continues to stop them, then the antidepressants are given really in a way that just kind of helps them have that little bit of a push. Mm-hmm. In the beginning, when we prescribe them, by we, I mean like the mental health professionals in general, but mostly psychiatrists, when we talk about prescribing medication, the initial time of prescribing is not supposed to be lifelong. It's supposed to be for a 6 month period. And then we wean the people off the medication. And then we hope that after, you know, going through therapy as well as taking medication, they've learned new skills and they've been able to kind of integrate those skills into their life. Mm-hmm. Once we remove the medication, we hope that we never have to put them on the medication. But sometimes people relapse, like I said, because there are so many other different factors that play a part. And so if they relapse significantly for a longer period of time, then we put them back on the medication for about a year. Mm-hmm. And then we wean them off the medication again. And if still there's that relapse, then we do consider the possibility of lifelong medication.
It's such an interesting point to think about this as being a tool. You know, this is a short-term crutch as such. So you're able to put things in place that will, you know, bring you out that. And we are going to talk about that next. That's what I want to speak about next, Dr. Thurai, about some of the lifestyle factors that can, and I'm not going to say prevent depression, but can certainly help you, whether you are struggling or you want to kind of future-proof yourself. Your message here is saying, which antidepressants have the lowest chance of effect on babies during pregnancy? Her message is about, are they safe to be on long-term? Someone's feeling in a catch-22 situations. We're looking at depression today in light of a new study that's come out by Our World in Data, analysed the number of prescriptions doled out in 22 countries worldwide and broke them down in terms of the most prescribed for depression, which was Iceland, interestingly enough. But This is really about helping you get the answers that you need, maybe some reassurances, and guiding us through the topic of depression is Dr. Thoraya, clinical psychologist. We should point out, as we were talking about medications earlier, Dr. T, that you don't prescribe, that this would be something that a doctor or psychiatrist would do, but obviously you work a lot with people who are using medication and can obviously talk at length about that as well. A message here is saying, which antidepressants have the lowest chance of effects on babies during pregnancy? I think this is a really good question because that can be a real barrier to a lot of women getting something that could really help them with, you know, prenatal depression and or anxiety. And it absolutely is possible to be on medication during a pregnancy. I don't know if you're able to mention specific names or maybe just some reassurances there.
Well, what we do know is that, I mean, you'll find this in many of the medical journals, is that most the medications that we would find the safest are the ones like sertraline, which is known as Zoloft, fluoxetine, that is known as Prozac. There are a couple of others that recommend, but the ones that are used the most are usually Zoloft and Prozac. Those are the ones that you'll see psychiatrists actually prescribe. But again, it really depends on the person. It depends on their history. It depends on their composition, their other medical factors. There's so many things that need to be taken into account. So this is definitely not something that people should just take without consulting a psychiatrist.
Thank you. Dr. Thoraya, a message here, and actually we've had a couple in this vein, but I think I know this listener is listening now, so I would like to go to this one, saying, when your husband is clearly going through depression and you don't know how to help, and they're not seeking help nor willing to do anything about it, it's affecting every aspect of our daily lives. How do I help without overstepping boundaries? It's an anonymous listener.
It's a very tricky answer, because the reality is that there are a lot of people that could benefit from seeking help. However, they don't, for many reasons. And, you know, I won't be able to be the perfect person to tell you, because you probably know your husband far more, not probably, you do know your husband more than I would. But what I can say is that sometimes it's good to be open and vulnerable with your partner about these things, and share with them how you're feeling, not necessarily what they're doing, but how you're feeling and how it's affecting you and how it's affecting the relationship that you're having with that individual. And not necessarily say that they may need to go for therapy or get medication or get help, but just to talk about the fact that, you know, that you want to be there for them, that you want to help them, that you are there to support them in anything that they need, and maybe suggest to do things together, like, you know, changing their diet and going on exercises with them, you know, doing things that could help them kind of see a different perspective, and maybe accept help from someone extremely close to them, and then hopefully work towards seeking help from someone else.
It's interesting that this listener is saying it's affecting every aspect of our daily lives, because we've had another message here saying, you know, my husband's had depression on and off. He's in a bad spot now. And as awful as it sounds, I find him really hard to be around. And I can well understand that. You know, it must affect, you know, your social life, your romantic life, how you view yourself as a partner. And, I'm not speaking for either of these listeners, but I would well imagine, you know, it's be a very hard thing to get your own head out of if you have got a partner who's in a really tough spot. It must affect your own mental health.
Of course. I mean, usually the person who is experiencing a mental health difficulty is not the only one who's being affected. It's everybody in the family, not just their partner, but if their children are around, parents, if you're living with your family. So everybody gets affected by it, because it is quite difficult, not from a shaming perspective or a judging perspective, but just from the perspective of, you know, seeing a person that you love suffer is painful for any individual. And this is, you know, the same way we see somebody, going through cancer treatment, going through any kind of physical ailment, we pain with them. We feel that pain with them. So someone going through depression can definitely bring down the mood, the environment at home. And it's important to also take care of yourself if you happen to be a partner or a loved one of somebody who is experiencing depression or any other type of mental health difficulty.
Dr. Thoraya, we're going to keep you. We've got a couple of questions that I just want to come to. Dr. Thoraya, clinical psychologist, with us today. We're having a deep dive into depression, and we've had a couple of messages, Thoraya, that I wish we had time to address properly. But to summarise both of them, these listeners have people in their lives who are really, really struggling with mental health. I'm talking mentions of suicidal thoughts, about, you know, not wanting to get out of bed, about refusing to seek any kind of professional help. And I wondered, in what sounds like it could be getting into emergency situations here, what do you advise anyone who is living with or knows someone who's incredibly vulnerable and could be a danger to themselves psychologically?
Well, it's quite tricky because, you know, with something like that, sometimes people may not necessarily be in the right state of mind, so they might not be quite receptive to getting the help that they deserve. One of the things that I would say is sometimes it's good if they're not looking to get the help themselves to go see a psychiatrist yourself and see what you can do, because sometimes psychiatrists are really good at helping them, you know, bring the individual in. Sometimes in extreme cases, when there could be some form of, you know, psychotic behavior, anything like that, there are medications that can be, you know, administered. I know it sounds really bad, but in secret, for the person to kind of stabilize before they can actually get the help that they deserve. But definitely, I would say, make sure to take care of yourself and seek help. Ask people around you, definitely family members, friends. You know, sometimes, you know, I know that people are scared of this word, but like having others intervene as well and getting that external support can be extremely beneficial, because carrying that weight on your shoulders alone could really hurt your own mental health.
Well said, indeed. Thank you, Thraya. And lastly, when we're thinking about moving forward, about bolstering your mental health, about, and I don't want to say bouncing back from depression, but I guess things that can work hand in hand with medication, the lifestyle factors, what would you love everyone to understand, to try to do, to incorporate in that battle?
The first and foremost thing I would say is make sure you get a good amount of sleep. Sleep is so important when it comes to hormonal balance. So getting anywhere between 7.5 to 9 hours of sleep a day is crucial. Making sure that your diet is minimal of a significant amount of caffeine, processed sugars. Make sure you get a good amount of vegetables, meat, chicken, fish into your diet. Stay away from like processed carbs, like really bad processed carbs like chips and things like that. Also, exercise. Exercise is so important. It releases endorphins. It helps even sometimes with oxytocin, depending who you're exercising with. Mm-hmm. Also, it just helps bolster the amount of feel-good hormones that you experience, dopamine, serotonin, things like that. But I would definitely say things like meditation, journaling, just taking care of yourself, doing things that you love, spend time with family if that's something that boosts your energy. Animals are extremely therapeutic as well. Yes, and the cats are super therapeutic. But definitely I want to highlight the major factors of sleep and food and exercise. Those three are extremely crucial because, you know, mainly when it comes to food, most of our dopamine and our serotonin, and even 50% of our GABA that's responsible for our circadian rhythm, which is our sleep cycle, or aids in our sleep cycle, is produced in the gut. So if we're not eating well, it's very difficult to feel well. And I know it's a really horrible cycle, because what ends up happening is when we're not feeling well, we don't eat. When we don't eat, we eat horribly. Mm-hmm. And then that cycle continues. So those three things would be the number, like the top three things that I have, but then definitely start to include some things like meditation, some breathing, some journaling,
mind,
artwork,
body, and soul.
Exactly.
Thraya,
exactly.
Thank you so, so much. Really, really appreciate your time as ever. And you and the team can be found at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.